Chapter 1. Conquests and Cultures. We do not live in the past, but the past in us. Conquest is a major part of that past, and a major shaper of the cultures of the world today. Wars of conquest have changed the language, the economy, and the moral universe of whole peoples. As a result of conquests, the Western Hemisphere is today a larger region of European civilization than Europe itself. Even those in the Western Hemisphere who hate European civilization express that hatred in a European language and denounce it as immoral by European standards of morality. The history of conquests is not just about the past, it is very much about the present and about how we came to be where we are economically, intellectually, and morally. While migrations have transferred knowledge, skills, technology, and economically valuable aptitudes around the world, conquests have played a more varied and ambiguous role. Where a technologically or organizationally more advanced people have conquered a people lagging behind in these respects, then conquest, like migration, has been a way of spreading the existing human capital of mankind and promoting the development of more human capital among more peoples. But where conquerors are clearly less economically or intellectually developed than those they conquer, a common situation for centuries, during which ancient civilizations in the Middle East were prey to mounted nomadic warriors from the steppes of Central Asia, then conquest has not promoted the spread of human capital, but instead has destroyed much of it where it existed and prevented civilization from spreading to militarily vulnerable areas. Ancient and irreplaceable manuscripts went up in flames when illiterate barbarian invaders or marauders set fire to libraries for the sheer pleasure of destruction. Roman conquerors spread a more advanced civilization from the Mediterranean to Western Europe, with momentous impact on the history of the world. But the destruction of the Roman Empire by invading barbarians produced one of the most catastrophic retrogressions of whole peoples ever seen. Scholars may debate how many centuries it took medieval Europe to recover the standard of living it had once enjoyed in Roman times, but what is not debatable is that it took centuries, and in some respects more than 1,000 years. The Moors' conquest of medieval Spain brought with it an Islamic culture that was, at that juncture in history, more advanced than Europe's in such fields as mathematics, science, medicine, and philosophy. In Asia, ancient Chinese culture likewise spread by conquest. At one period of history or another, conquest has encompassed virtually all peoples, either as conquerors or as victims, and the consequences have been wide-ranging as well. Some conquests have been followed by systematic exterminations of the vanquished, as in Rome's conquest of Carthage, nor have such draconian policies been limited to major conquerors of historic dimensions. The massacres of the Tutsi by the Hutu, and vice versa, in late 20th century Africa, and ethnic cleansing in the Balkan Wars of the same era, clearly show that it does not take a great power to create great human tragedies. Nor have the much idealized Polynesians been immune. On the Chatham Islands, 500 miles east of New Zealand, centuries of independence came to a brutal end for the Moriori people in December 1835. On November 19th of that year, a ship carrying 500 Maori armed with guns, clubs, and axes arrived, followed on December 5th by a shipload of 400 more Maori. Groups of Maori began to walk through Moriori settlements, announcing that the Moriori were now their slaves, and killing those who objected. A Maori conqueror explained, "We took possession in accordance with our customs, and we caught all the people. Not one escaped. Some ran away from us. These we killed, and others we killed. But what of that? It was in accordance with our customs." Spontaneous atrocities and deliberate, systematic terror have long marked the path of the conqueror. The Mongol hordes who swept across vast reaches of Central Asia, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East cultivated an image of ruthless barbarities as a calculated strategy to demoralize future victims. But although the Mongols excelled in such practices, they had no monopoly of them. The Normans did the same. Emperor Basil II of the Byzantine Empire in the 11th century ordered the blinding of 99 of every 100 Bulgarian captives, leaving each 100th man with only one eye to lead the others back home, so as to provide graphic evidence of the emperor's treatment of his enemies. It was a common practice in the Ottoman Empire to present the Sultan with pyramids of severed heads of enemy soldiers, usually defenseless prisoners, sometimes numbering in the thousands. 20th century conquests have been equally hideous. The Japanese conquest of the Chinese capital of Nanking in 1937 was followed by an orgy of rapes of thousands of women living there, the use of Chinese soldiers and civilians for bayonet practice, and a general wanton slaughter of civilians. Similar atrocities marked Japanese conquests throughout Southeast Asia during the Second World War. Their allies, the Nazis in Germany, set new lows for brutality and dehumanization, of which the Holocaust against the Jews was only the worst example. While conquest has often produced horrifying tragedies, its consequences have extended far beyond those tragedies. In some cases, where whole ways of life have changed in the wake of conquest, later generations of the conquered peoples have been born into an enlarged world of ideas, of technology, and of possibilities undreamed of by their ancestors. It is both unnecessary and impossible to determine the net advantages or disadvantages of conquest. Often, the benefits and the losses have each been of staggering dimensions and long durations, with consequences that have been cultural, institutional, and biological. Causes and consequences of conquests. Conquests often have not only cultural consequences, but also cultural antecedents. While one culture may be more effective militarily and another culture more effective economically, in many cases the two things interact. For example, more efficient methods of agriculture or industry, capable of supporting higher population densities on a given amount of land, can give one side decisive military advantages in launching attacks with larger armies, whose conquests then spread more effective economic methods to new lands or peoples. In ancient times, sedentary agriculture was an epoch-making advance beyond seeking food by hunting or gathering the spontaneous products of nature, or by transient slash-and-burn planting methods. Because sedentary agriculture supported much higher population concentrations, it spread and transformed the world, not only by example, but also by conquest. Those groups still practicing slash-and-burn methods of cultivation, which usually support only thin population densities, were often forced off their lands and up into the hills or out into the hinterlands and backwaters by people from regions with more dense populations made possible by sedentary agriculture. Hunter-gatherers, who had not yet achieved even primitive forms of agriculture, were of course even more thinly spread, and therefore even more vulnerable. Rice cultivation supports especially heavy population densities, so it is not surprising that the irrigation systems crucial to rice cultivation in many parts of Asia were spread by conquests in China, India, and the southeastern regions of the continent. Cultural consequences of conquests. In Europe, 1,000 years after the Roman Empire had come and gone, those parts of the continent once conquered by the Romans remained culturally different and more advanced than those regions which had not been. The Christian religion and Latin letters long remained symbols of this cultural demarcation between Western Europe and Eastern Europe, though other cultural differences persisted for centuries after Eastern Europe adopted Christianity and parts of it began to use the Latin alphabet. Similarly, in Southeast Asia, those regions conquered by the ancient Chinese dynasties continued to incorporate aspects of the Chinese culture into their own ways of life centuries after they became independent nations and China ceased to be an empire. Cultures in prolonged contact with one another usually influence one another, whether that contact is due to conquest, migration, or commerce. At the most elementary level, material things are interchanged, whether these be products of industry or of nature. Sugar, cocoa, maize, and rubber were just some of the products of the Western Hemisphere that became known throughout Europe, Asia, and Africa as a result of conquest. while horses, guns, liquor, and literacy all became familiar to the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere by the same process. Particular skills are often also interchanged between conquerors and conquered, and these too can range widely, from agricultural skills to such intellectual skills as mathematics, philosophy, and astronomy. The Slavic and Baltic peoples, whose lands were overrun by German conquerors during the Middle Ages and the early modern era, were exposed to, and to some extent incorporated into, German culture. Later, Polish immigrants to the United States from Prussia brought artisan and industrial skills largely lacking in Polish immigrants from outside the German cultural orbit. These Prussian Poles were often more literate, Lutheran, and familiar with the world of modern commercial and industrial societies. Among the relatively few Polish immigrants who became machinists, shoemakers, weavers, tailors, or cabinet makers in the United States, most came from Prussia, while the majority of other Polish immigrants were unskilled laborers, many of whom ended up in the coal mines of Pennsylvania. Not all these skills among Prussian Poles were absorbed within Prussia itself. Hundreds of thousands of Poles migrated westward to the industrial heartland of Europe in the Ruhr Valley to work in the industries there. It was much the same story halfway around the world in India. Among the millions of Telugu-speaking people in eastern India during the colonial era, some lived under the direct rule of the British conquerors, while others lived under Indian princes. When these peoples were united, years after India's independence, into a newly created state of Andhra Pradesh, the Andhras, who had lived under British rule, proved to be overwhelming competition for the Telanganans, who had lived under Indian princes. Andhras not only bested the Telanganans on civil service examinations, taking over great numbers of government jobs as a result, but also outperformed them in agriculture, where they were able to buy out Telanganan farmers and make their farms much more productive and more profitable. Cultural dissemination among the conquered peoples is neither automatic nor uniform, however, and the consequences of uneven dissemination may be momentous and long-lasting. As will be seen in the chapter on the British, the technological and entrepreneurial achievements of the English did not inspire similar achievements among the Welsh or the Irish whom they conquered, though among the Scots such achievements not only inspired imitation, but also further developments, which ultimately enabled the Scots to surpass the achievements of the English themselves in some fields, such as medicine and engineering. Where the spread of skills from the conquerors to the conquered proceeds unevenly among different groups of the conquered people, sometimes due to varying proximity to the cultural centers of the conquerors, and sometimes due simply to different receptivities to the conqueror's culture, this can also create greater economic inequality among the conquered. Even more explosively, it can create a reshuffling of the relative positions of different groups in the society, so that historically poorer and lower-ranked groups rise above their erstwhile superiors and remain above them after the conquerors have withdrawn and the country has become independent. Thus, the rise of the Igbos in Nigeria and the rise of the Tamils in Sri Lanka during the colonial era set off bitter social reactions that lasted into the era of independence, ultimately leading to civil war in both countries. Different groups in the same conquered nation may also react differently in terms of resistance to or collaboration with the conqueror. Thus, during World War II, the Serbs in Nazi-occupied Yugoslavia formed a guerrilla movement, while many of the Croats collaborated with the Nazi puppet regime. Halfway around the world, at the same time, the resistance movement against the Japanese occupation of Malaya was overwhelmingly Chinese, while the collaborators were more often Malays. Such differences left legacies of intergroup bitterness, long after the war itself was over and the conquerors were gone. In earlier centuries, some of the Balkan peoples conquered by the Ottoman Empire converted to Islam and became part of the privileged or ruling classes in that region, while others were subordinated to Muslim overlords, again adding another legacy of lasting intergroup bitterness among the already fragmented peoples of that region. Sometimes the differences among the conquered peoples were not ethnic, but varied by social class. Often the higher classes among the conquered people have adopted the language and the ways of the conqueror in order to gain a share in the wealth and power of the new order, while the masses, lacking such tempting opportunities, have clung to the native language and the old ways. This cleavage may reach such an extreme that the very laws and business of government are carried on in a language foreign to the majority of the population subjected to those laws and that government, as in Norman England or in 20th century Ceylon. Not all conquests involve a culturally more advanced conqueror, as these conquerors themselves have clearly understood where they adopted part or most of the culture of the conquered peoples. Thus, the Ottoman Turks became Muslims after conquering Islamic nations, as the Slavs became Christians after invading Christian Europe, as the Manchus adopted Chinese culture wholesale even before conquering China, and as the ancient Romans absorbed the culture of the Greeks, whom they conquered. Other conquerors have neither sought to acquire the culture of the conquered nor to impose their own culture on them, but simply to collect tribute or acquire booty. This latter kind of conquest has shaded off into simple predation, forays for both material booty and the carrying off of people as slaves to be sold or used later. Such predations remained a major activity of various peoples around the world until the rise of nation-states with armies, navies, and fortified towns made such forays too risky and too seldom successful. Part of the reason for this historic change was the changing technology of military conquests. Military technology. The ever-changing technology of warfare has been no more evenly spread among the peoples of the world than other cultural advantages. Mastery of fighting on horseback made Central Asians the greatest conquerors in the world for centuries on end, winning victories and empires from China to Eastern Europe. Only after the development of more formidable fortifications and the invention and perfection of handguns and cannon was the cavalry charge drastically reduced in its effectiveness, changing the balance of power among peoples and giving rise to new nations and empires based on the new technology. The rise of gunpowder weapons in particular marked the rise of Europeans as conquerors on the world stage, whereas before then Europe had had difficulties even defending itself against the invasions of Mongols, Turks, and Moors. It was symbolic of this dramatic turnaround that the year the Spaniards finally liberated the last of their country from Moorish rule was the same year when Columbus set sail across the Atlantic, marking the beginning of the age of European worldwide empires. The very nature of European dominance evolved in step with the evolution of guns and cannon. Early, crude, inaccurate, and slow-loading firearms had no decisive advantage against fast-charging horsemen and fast-shooting archers. Although Europeans began making cannons in the first half of the 14th century, it was two centuries later before military battles began to be won by field artillery. The immobility of heavy early cannons, which limited their usefulness on land, was not as much of a handicap at sea, however, where the warship itself provided the mobility for its cannon, leading to European dominance on the oceans of the world long before the mass territorial conquests which created European land empires overseas. The technology of shipbuilding and the science of navigation were crucial in determining which European powers would become the militarily predominant ones, both in Europe itself and overseas, raising some to new heights and reducing others from their former preeminence. Venice, for example, was the leading sea power of the continent for centuries before the era of sail and cannon, but later had to be protected from Spanish naval attack by the warships of their British and Dutch allies in the early 17th century. With the development of lighter, more mobile, more accurate, and faster firing artillery, as well as corresponding advances in pistols and rifles, the balance of military power shifted decisively to the Europeans, on land as well as at sea. Environmental factors. Patterns of conquest have not been determined solely by technology or even by culture in general. Geography, including disease environments, has played a major role in the history of conquest, as it has in the history of cultural evolution in general. The steppes of Central Asia and the plains of Eastern Europe have been far better settings for cavalry charges than the mountainous terrain of the Balkans or the heavily forested parts of Central Europe, while island nations such as Britain and Japan have of course been wholly immune. China tried to create the effects of natural barriers with its Great Wall, as Hadrian's Wall in Britain and the Maginot Line in pre-war France attempted the same thing on a smaller scale. Geographic barriers have spared some peoples from conquest or delayed its coming. Mountainous terrain has permitted independence to persist in some places long after the adjoining lowlands have been overrun by invaders. Morocco, Ceylon, Abyssinia, Scotland, and Tibet are just some of the places in which this has been so. However, geographical barriers have been a mixed blessing, as technological and cultural backwardness have likewise been the fates of many of these isolated regions. Moreover, the relative poverty of such regions has also been one of the deterrents to conquest, along with the fighting abilities of mountain men, for there was little or no profit to be had from the conquest of many such areas. Differential resistance to one another's diseases, which played a key role in the conquest of the Western Hemisphere, retarded the conquest of Africa until much later in history, because it was the indigenous peoples who succumbed to new, mixed disease environments in the Americas, while it was the Europeans who were fatally vulnerable to the diseases of tropical Africa until quinine and other modern medical and public health measures made it possible for them to survive amid the tropical diseases that flourished south of the Sahara. The Atlantic and Pacific Oceans long protected the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere from the conquerors of the rest of the world, and, even as late as the first half of the 20th century, these oceans made isolationism a viable option for the United States, as it was not for most of the nations of Europe or Asia. However, smaller bodies of water may facilitate, rather than impede, military attacks, for huge differences between the high cost of land transport and the low cost of water transport can be as important militarily as it has been economically. During the Crimean War, for example, the British and the French attacking forces were supplied by water, while the Russian defenders at Sevastopol had to be supplied by land, since the waters were controlled by British and French warships. Even with approximately 125,000 peasant carts requisitioned to supply the defenders from their own adjacent homeland, their limited supplies of ammunition did not permit them to reply in kind to the barrages fired at them from the sea. Nor was this simply a matter of conditions favoring attackers or defenders in general. Both in Spain and in Russia, Napoleon's attacking armies met disaster when they had to be supplied over land, while the opposing armies were supplied across water. The inaccessibility of African rivers to ocean-going warships made this continent less vulnerable to European naval power than much of the Western Hemisphere was. The Dutch, for example, could send ocean-going vessels more than 100 miles up the Hudson River to establish an outpost at what would later become the city of Albany. No river in Africa was that accessible, whether due to insufficient water levels or, more commonly, sandbars, cascades, and waterfalls. The shallow coastal waters in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa meant that large European warships could often not get close enough to the shore in many places, necessitating the loading of European troops into smaller boats, which could in many places be effectively opposed by Africans in similar-sized boats, particularly in the early centuries before European firearms had developed the accuracy and speed of firing that they would have in later eras. Forms of subjugation. Ultimately, it is not simply territory that is conquered, it is people, and their subjugation can take the form not only of political subordination, but also of enslavement, whether in their own homelands or in other lands to which they are transported. Here, too, environmental factors have been major influences, more so than race, for example, in determining who would and would not be enslaved. While slavery existed around the world for thousands of years and has been abolished generally only within the past 2 centuries, it tended to decline with the rise of many powerful nation-states, whose armies and navies stood between their own people and marauders from outside who might attempt to capture and enslave them. Thus, the consolidation of nation-states around the world reduced the number of peoples who remained vulnerable to enslavement. The regions of the world which continued to be subjected to mass enslavement had much more in common geographically than racially. Typically, these were regions where internal geographical barriers made it more difficult to consolidate political control over areas large enough to produce powerful nation-states, able to protect their populations from marauding outsiders. The Balkan Mountains, which fragmented peoples culturally and isolated them from the economic and intellectual advances of the outside world, made this region a major supplier of slaves for centuries before Europeans turned to Africa as a source of slaves for the Western Hemisphere. Such geographical handicaps had other counterparts which kept the peoples of sub-Saharan Africa isolated from one another, as that whole region remained insulated from the outside world by the vast Sahara Desert to the north and three oceans on its other sides. In Asia as well, geographical isolation and the technological backwardness which so often went with it left many vulnerable peoples in stateless societies like those of Bali, which was raided for tens of thousands of slaves by peoples from more fortunate places. Other stateless peoples, or peoples only nominally part of states which lacked effective control of remote regions, continued to be victimized by marauders who captured and enslaved them. Hill tribes, slash-and-burn agriculturalists, scattered bands of nomads, and others living in the remote backwaters of Asia continued to be raided and enslaved on into the 20th century. In short, what successively removed various peoples of the world from the ranks of those vulnerable to being enslaved was the long process of consolidation of state power, whether their own or that of European imperialist nations. Thus, slavery was ended in the Philippines, for example, only after the American conquest of the islands, which did not simply replace the pre-existing authorities with new ones, but replaced them with a more powerful government in firmer control. In the Indonesian islands as well, the advance of Dutch power marked the retreat of slavery. More generally, the spread of Western imperialism in Asia during the 19th century was the principal factor in the decline of slavery there. In Africa, slavery remained resistant on into the 20th century, but here too, it was the consolidation of European power that forced back the frontiers of slavery. Whether it was the consolidation of French power in Morocco or Senegal, British power in many parts of Africa, or other European power in other regions of the continent. What was crucial to this development was the emergence in Western civilization of a general revulsion against slavery in the late 18th and early 19th century. This anti-slavery movement became and remained politically powerful enough to force political leaders and colonial officials into opposition to slavery, regardless of whether they personally felt such revulsion or not. The other crucial factor was that the West had such overwhelming military superiority at the time as to be able to enforce anti-slavery policies around the world, as it imposed its will in other matters. Relations between conquerors and conquered. Sometimes the conquerors have simply established themselves as a ruling class whose members all take precedence over all members of the conquered peoples. In principle, this was the situation of Muslims in the lands of the Islamic conquests, where Christians and Jews were explicitly placed on a lower plane in the law itself and dared not defend themselves, even when struck by Muslim adults or stoned by Muslim children. Similarly, blacks in South Africa long remained in a sweeping legal subordination to whites, compounded by a degree of poverty not usually experienced by Christians or Jews in the Ottoman Empire, where both were often more prosperous than the Muslim population to whom they were legally subordinated. Other conquerors have co-opted either the existing aristocracy among the conquered peoples or particular talented individuals of whatever social origins who were permitted to rise to wealth and power when those individuals served the interests of the conquerors. In the Roman Empire, non-Romans could rise to high command in the Roman legions, become governors of provinces, or even emperor. In principle, such was also the situation in the Soviet Union, though in practice, Slavs in general and Russians in particular dominated the strategic heights of power, just as they had under the Tsars, when the country was more candidly referred to as the Russian Empire. Sometimes conquerors have settled concentrations of their own people in strategic places in the conquered lands in order to secure themselves militarily against external or internal enemies. Both the Roman Empire in ancient times and the Ottoman Empire during the Middle Ages settled their soldiers or military veterans in strategic locations. At other times, conquerors have granted land and other privileges to particular foreigners, chosen for their fighting qualities, to serve the same purpose of securing an otherwise vulnerable conquered region. Thus, in medieval times, Hungarian fighting men became petty nobles in the border region of Poland, and both Hungarian and German nobles were settled in parts of Croatia, while Anglo-Norman nobility were similarly settled in parts of Scotland. Where the concern has been with internal unrest, rather than with external military threats, politically reliable elements of the conqueror's existing population have been resettled into newly conquered territories, as both Turks and Jews were resettled into parts of the Balkans conquered by the Ottoman Empire. Later, as the Habsburg Empire pushed the Ottomans back in the Balkans, they settled Croats, Serbs, and Germans in the frontier zones for the sake of security. The Aztecs followed similar policies in their empire in the Western Hemisphere. The culture of the conquered peoples has sometimes been targeted for extermination, even where the people themselves are not, but are urged or forced toward adoption of the conqueror's language, technology, and way of life. Attempts to turn the peoples of France's African Empire into black Frenchmen, Russification campaigns among the conquered subjects of the Tsars, and the spread of Islamic culture in the wake of Muslim conquests across North Africa and the Middle East are just some examples of this pattern. Other conquerors balanced many considerations as they sought to preserve their hegemony at minimal cost to themselves, which in many circumstances meant allowing cultural autonomy to the conquered. Indirect rule in much of the British Empire often involved such cultural accommodation for the sake of maintaining political control at low cost, and a similar pattern was common among the Aztecs in pre-Columbian times. However, even a given conquering nation could follow very different policies in very different places at the same time. The British, for example, followed a policy of cultural extermination where their goal was colonization in the strict sense of establishing new settlements of transplanted members of the imperial race, whether in North America, Australia, or closer to home in Ireland in the 17th century. Racial differences between the conqueror and the conquered have been sometimes sharp, sometimes not, and have sometimes been submerged under other differences that mattered more at the time, such as differences in religion. The degree to which physical differences between the rulers and the subjugated mattered to each is an empirical question rather than a foregone conclusion. Racism has scarred and bloodied the histories of lands around the world, but Northern Ireland, India, and the Middle East are contemporary reminders of the enduring and lethal hatreds that have revolved around religion. History's crusades, pogroms, jihads, and inquisitions underscore the point. Secular religions or ideologies have likewise claimed their millions of victims, from the killing fields of Kampuchea to the Soviet gulags. Race has been a major enduring factor in some conquests, but can claim no monopoly as a cause of man's inhumanity to man. The material things and the intellectual and moral concepts spread by conquest do not all originate within the conquering peoples themselves. Much of the cultural advances in mathematics, science, philosophy, and other fields spread by Arab conquests and absorbed into medieval European civilization originated with peoples who were not Arabs, but Persians, Hindus, and others. The fact that Europeans used the term Arabic numerals to refer to numbers which in fact originated among Hindus in India was symptomatic of this role of conquest in spreading cultural features originating elsewhere, either from among the conquered, in the case of so-called Arabic numerals, or from other independent nations in other parts of the world. The Islamic empires, for example, also transmitted to Europeans such things as paper and printing from China, which the Islamic conquests in Asia made them aware of before the Europeans penetrated that part of the world. While migrations compete with conquest as methods of spreading cultures over vast distances, conquest has in many cases facilitated migration, not only among the conquering peoples themselves, but also among others, who become more willing to move to new areas now made more secure under the conqueror's hegemony. Thus, Jewish peddlers and merchants followed in the wake of the Roman legions, as Lebanese peddlers and merchants would in later centuries follow in the wake of European conquerors in West Africa, and people from India and China would migrate to colonial Malaya after British hegemony had been established there. Neither racial nor cultural affinities with the conquerors are necessary for this to happen. All that is necessary is for the conqueror to establish a degree of law and order under which others can feel secure. This law and order need not be equal or just for all, and seldom is. What is crucial is its dependability, which involves not only the physical power to enforce its edicts, but also a legal and political system whose predictability has not been fatally undermined by corruption or caprice. Where weak, corrupt, and capricious indigenous governments have been supplanted by stronger and more dependable colonial governments, immigration has often increased, even when those who immigrated were never accorded the same rights as the imperial race or even the conquered native population. The Chinese, for example, prospered economically in much of colonial Southeast Asia, where they were legally third-class citizens. So did emigrants from India, who went to live under various European colonial governments in East Asia, Fiji, and the Caribbean. National independence and self-determination of peoples. However profound the effects of conquests, and however long-lasting, nevertheless, empires fall, and even before that, particular peoples break free of their conquerors. Just as the Spaniards spent centuries driving out their Moorish conquerors, so the Russians drove out their Mongol overlords, and much of Europe and the Middle East erupted again and again in revolt against Ottoman, Habsburg, and other empires. In more recent times, post-World War II uprisings in Indonesia, Algeria, Kenya, and Rhodesia brought independence to these countries and undoubtedly influenced imperial authorities to grant independence to other colonies in the less developed world before overt resistance reached similar proportions. At one time, the struggle between conquered and conquerors was largely a matter between those directly concerned. However, just as slavery became a general moral and political issue in Western civilization in the 19th century, so the right of self-determination of peoples became a general moral and political issue in the 20th century. In both cases, the overwhelming military power of the West stood behind these moral and political imperatives. For example, the victorious allies of the First World War carved up the defeated Habsburg and Ottoman empires into smaller states run by formerly subjugated peoples, such as the Poles, Czechs, and Hungarians, and the various southern Slavs, who were then lumped together in a newly created Yugoslavia. President Woodrow Wilson's championing the right of self-determination of peoples was a landmark in this development, though his own Secretary of State confided in his diary the misgivings he had about the President's words. These phrases will certainly come home to roost and cause much vexation. The President is a phrase-maker par excellence. He admires trite sayings and revels in formulating them. But when he comes to their practical application, he is so vague that their worth may well be doubted. He apparently never thought out in advance where they would lead or how they would be interpreted by others. In fact, he does not seem to care so that his words sound well. The gift of clever phrasing may be a curse unless the phrases are put to the test of sound, practical application before being uttered. Just 10 days later, Secretary Lansing returned to the issue of self-determination and wrote in his diary, "The phrase is simply loaded with dynamite. It will raise hopes which can never be realized. It will, I fear, cost thousands of lives. What a calamity that the phrase was ever uttered. What misery will it cause? Think of the feelings of the author when he counts the dead who died because he coined a phrase." The military and political viability of the newly created states, and the dangers to the peace of Europe as a whole when the international balance of power was made fragile by the existence of so many small and vulnerable countries, were considerations lost in the euphoria of victory and the heady process of nation-building, or more accurately, empire dismemberment. But the importance of these factors was painfully revealed by the subsequent breakdown of the balance of power in Europe, as Hitler was able to pick off, one by one, countries that would have been much more difficult to conquer when they were part of a consolidated empire, thus enabling Nazi Germany to begin shifting the military balance of power in its own favor, even before the onset of the Second World War. Nor did the damage end with the end of the war that this fragmentation of Europe had helped foster. Even in the last decade of the 20th century, there were still consequences from the artificial creation of new states after the First World War. Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia both came apart in the 1990s, peacefully in the first case and amid hideous atrocities in the second. At the same time, the breakup of another multinational empire, the Soviet Union, likewise unleashed civil wars within the newly independent republics. The right of self-determination has had a high cost. Whether or not it was ultimately worth that cost is another question. Unfortunately, it is a question seldom asked by those who have repeated the phrase, any more than it was asked by Woodrow Wilson. Nor is this issue confined to Europe. The breakup of empires seldom, if ever, restores the world that existed before conquest. The practical question is therefore not how the conquest should be viewed, either morally or politically, but what options now exist in a world irretrievably changed by the conquests of the past. The chapters that follow. In seeking to assess the role of conquest in the cultural evolution of peoples, it is of course impossible to present conquest in isolation from the many other influences that interweave with it to determine cultural and other outcomes. Thus, the history of conquered peoples cannot be understood if it is limited to the era of conquest or even to the role of conquest alone, since our subject is as much cultural evolution as it is conquests. The history of the peoples covered here, the British, the Slavs, the Africans, and the Western Hemisphere Indians, includes strong influences of both. The antecedents and the long-run consequences of conquest are integral parts of the story. This is especially so for nations or peoples that have played the roles both of conquered and conqueror at different periods of history, for what happened in between is a major part of the story of the cultural evolution that reversed their roles. The differing physical settings in which peoples and their cultures evolved facilitated some things and limited others, so these geographical influences are examined in each of these chapters. One of the most important things influenced by geography is the size and diversity of the area over which economic and cultural interactions can take place, for this strongly affects not only the economic well-being of the people, but even more fundamentally, their own development of the skills, knowledge, and wider cultural exposure that can be summarized as human capital. Whether people are united by navigable waterways or cut off by rugged mountains or other geographical barriers has enormous cultural as well as economic and political significance. The geographical differences between Eastern and Western Europe, or between Europe and Africa, for example, are major influences on the economic and cultural evolution of the peoples living in these regions of the world. Moreover, these cultural differences persist after these peoples emigrate to other countries and continents. Merely to say that there is cultural evolution, and in particular that this evolution has dramatically changed the relative position of peoples, nations, and whole civilizations, moves us beyond the narrow confines of our own times to look at the broader tapestry of human events. This vast historical scene also has implications for the world around us today, and especially for reconsidering the beliefs and theories that might seem plausible within the narrower confines of the contemporary world, but which do not hold up when a more sweeping array of evidence from other times and places is examined. Our first history of a conquered people begins in the time of the Roman Empire. By then, Other great civilizations had already arisen, and some fallen, in China, in India, in Persia, and in ancient Greece. But much of the world that would later be considered civilized had by no means achieved that status yet. The greatest of the civilizations of Europe were still those on the Mediterranean, those most accessible to the great non-European civilizations of that era. Parts of Europe farther away, Scandinavia, the British Isles, or what would later become Russia, were centuries or millennia behind the level of civilization already developed in ancient Greece and Rome. Agriculture had by no means reached all parts of these outer regions yet, and nothing like the literature of the Greeks and Romans existed in such places, many of which did not even have written languages. Nations and governments, much less empires, were as yet unknown in these regions. Our story opens in an island not yet part of the civilization of its time, among illiterate tribal peoples, far removed in distance and culture from the glories of Rome. It begins in Britain.